was well above the legal limit. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
Vermont's House lawmakers are deciding whether to follow the state Senate's lead and approve same-sex marriage. The bill needs a minimum 100 votes to override Governor Jim Douglas's expected veto. Many constituents sent angry emails to the governor warning a veto would amount to bigotry, but others praised the governor for trying to keep marriage strictly between a man and a woman. New York City police are investigating apparent hate mail sent to staff members at Columbia University's Teachers College. Authorities say the mail contained drawings of swastikas and a noose. There were also racially charged incidents reported against Columbia's faculty some 2 years ago. Authorities say no arrests were made. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Vital Projects Fund, supporting the Museum of Modern Art, now showing Martin Kippenberger, The Problem Perspective, at MOMA.org.
Are these people in your carpool?
This is Michelle Norris.
I'm Jim Meadows.
This is Ira Glass.
Hi, this is Steve Inskeep with NPR News. Beep, beep,
beep, beep, yeah. Whether you're coming or going, you depend on us to keep you informed. We depend on you for financial support to make that possible. Give to our member match fund today, and we'll use your dollars on April 15th to challenge others to help make great programs possible on WILL. Go to willpledge.org or call 217-244-9455.
Programs on WILL AM are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. Coming April 14th, experience the National Philharmonic of Russia with featured soloist Demos Matsuyev. More information is available at KrannertCenter.com.
Good morning and welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. We're glad to have you with us. The producers for our program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. Over the past 30 years, there's been a significant increase in obesity among both children and adults in the United States. For individuals, this means an increased risk of heart disease, diabetes, stroke. For society, it means higher costs for health care. And here's the question we want to try to consider this morning. Should we, as a matter of public policy, work to reverse these trends? And if we say the answer to the question is yes, well, what's the best way to promote healthy behavior? This morning, in this hour of the show, we'll try to explore some of the causes and consequences of obesity. And our guest is Robert Kestner. He is professor in the Department of Economics at University of Illinois, Chicago. He's also a member of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs. In addition, he is a research associate for the National Bureau of Economic Research. And he is one of the contributors to the Illinois report for 2009. We've discussed this report before here on the program, some of its aspects. It's something that has been put together by the Institute of Government and Public Affairs now for several years. And it takes a look at a number of issues, things like the economy, education, health care, other sorts of issues here in Illinois. If you'd like to read it, you can read it online if you go to the website of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs. Also, if you'd like to have a print copy, you can get one from them. And among other things, you can read an article on this subject that Professor Kestner wrote for this publication. As we talk here this morning, questions are welcome, certainly. Well, we only ask callers to try to keep their questions brief so we can get in as many people as possible. But you're certainly welcome to participate in the conversation. Anyone is. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. At any point here, you can call us here in Champaign-Urbana. Again, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Professor Kestner, hello.
Hi, David.
Thanks for talking. I'm fine. Thanks, and yourself?
Very well. Thanks.
Good. Well, just as a way of starting out, I suppose I might ask about the choice of this particular topic to talk about and to make the focus of this kind of big report looking at the Illinois and economy and education, a lot of other issues. I when it comes to healthcare, I'm sure you could have picked a variety of things to focus on. Why was it that you chose this?
Well, as you noted, the Illinois Report is an annual publication by the Institute of Government and Public Affairs. And in previous ones, we've done a little more general types of analyses of the healthcare situation in Illinois, and cost of healthcare, Medicaid, things like that. So this year, we decided to pick obesity. Clearly, you know, obesity is one of the major public health problems that the country faces. It's on the agenda of the federal policymakers, state policymakers in Illinois and everywhere else. And actually, it's a global problem. Obesity is growing in other countries also. So it really has become a big public policy issue, a big public health issue. So we thought we would make a contribution in this regard for this year.
Yeah. And it looks very clear if you take a look, for example, at some of the graphs that you have here, that for both men and women in the state of Illinois and in the United States, the numbers, the percentage of the population that has some serious issues with their weight has gone up from a point of, looks like maybe about, 15%. Yeah, something like that in 1995 to recently. Now we're up to close to getting close for the 30%. Men, close to 30%, and maybe somewhere in between 25% and 30% for women. So, right. Clearly, there is an uptrend. And if you compare people in Illinois with people in the rest of the country, we're pretty much right on that same line.
That's right. Illinois is pretty much the average, but being the average in this case is not so good because everybody's getting more obese throughout the country, and that's the problem that we all face now. What are the consequences of that? What are the causes of that? And should we do anything? And if so, what? So there's a lot of popular ideas out there. I think a little more scrutiny makes suggest some of them aren't as intuitively good as we might think. So.
And maybe we should just review. I would think that people would have gotten this message because it's something that we talk about a lot, but should just again remind people of what the consequences of being significantly above your ideal body weight.
Right. It is associated with early death and more chronic illness and greater healthcare use. So, I mean, that's the real cost of problem.
And that clearly, that's when you ask this question. Well, what are the public policy implications? Clearly, that the last thing that you mentioned there, the increased use of healthcare, and that what that contributes overall to the cost of healthcare. That's the concern.
Right. That is a big concern of people. But also in addition to that, I mean, the government through a variety of policies have influenced, could have influenced significantly obesity. For example, all the agricultural subsidies that keep the price of food very low, that could have contributed to obesity. The zoning and land use regulations or the creation of the highway system that's expanded suburbanization, that might have increased obesity because people drive more, walk less, things like that. So, in addition to this kind of, well, we all have to pay for the healthcare costs, there's also the notion that, well, the government's done a lot of things that might have actually encouraged people to become obese and, it bears some responsibility to address that problem directly.
Mm. Is it actually possible to put a number that is a dollar figure on the increase in how much more we're paying for healthcare, or how much we're paying for healthcare that one can be, as directly as you can, attributed to this problem?
I think it's a little difficult. I mean, I don't think any of the numbers are really that accurate. I mean, because it's very hard to identify exactly what the cost of obesity are in terms of morbidity, mortality, and healthcare costs. But it's in the billions of dollars, even for Illinois. I think one estimate I saw, I don't know if you've seen it, It's about $3.5 billion in 1999. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's not a trivial sum of money that we're talking about.
So clearly, if we could address this particular issue, we could get people to be a little healthier, and we could bring down rates of things like heart disease and diabetes and so forth, there would be something, that would be a noticeable impact
right.
on what we spend on health care.
Yeah, some people argue that, you know, obesity is one of the, you know, most important, if not the predominant cause of the increase in chronic disease like diabetes, and that 70% or so of all the growth in healthcare costs over the last 30 years is due to obesity. Now, I think that's a little bit of an overstatement, but it does, you know, get to the point that you were suggesting, that if we could get obesity levels back to where they were 10 or 20 years ago, it's very likely that healthcare costs would be significantly lower as a result.
Yeah. Just very quickly, let me introduce again our guest for this hour, Robert Kestner. He's professor in the University of Illinois at Chicago's Department of Economics. He's also a member of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs, and has written about economic issues that have to do with health and healthcare, and is a contributor to this year's Illinois 2009 report put together by the Institute of Government and Public Affairs, and looks at a number of issues, economy, education, health, healthcare. And if you'd like to read it, you can go to their website of IGPA, and you can read it there, or you can get a copy. And questions are welcome too, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Clearly, this is a complicated thing, and it has to do there with a number of things. It has to do with what people eat, and it has to do with how they eat, and it has to do with their level of physical activity and their lifestyle, and all of these things contribute. It seems to me, though, that largely when we've talked about this issue, we have focused on it as an issue of personal behavior and personal responsibility, and have said something like, well, you know, we're trying to educate people. We're trying to get them to think about how they live and that then make good decisions for themselves. And generally we've made it that kind of an issue. What do we gain by, though, making this a public policy issue, and in fact, asking a question like, well, what factors are there outside of personal behavior or things that government might actually do that influence personal behavior, and shift some of the focus off of just, you know, what people as individuals do?
No, I think it's a really important point that you raise, and a lot of the public policies that have been brought forth to address the problem, you know, take up the issue that, well, you know, we've caused some of the problem and we can change some of the problem. So, for example, we have large farm subsidies. Illinois is a state that benefits greatly from farm subsidies for our corn farmers, for example. But this has reduced the price of corn sweeteners based on corn, and has lowered the price of soft drinks and all types of calorie-dense foods that use such sweeteners. I'm old enough to remember that the cost of a soda really hasn't changed all that much over the last 30 years, not because the cost of producing hasn't gone up, but some of the inputs, for example, why all sodas have switched from using sugar to corn syrup sweeteners is because these prices have declined relative to sugar, and that's helped keep the price of soda low, so we consume more of it than we otherwise would. This is a direct result of some agricultural policy. So, you know, one response is, well, let's tax sodas more, or soft drinks, what I call soda, because I'm from the East Coast, pop in the Midwest. And, you know, is that going to be successful? Are we going to really solve the obesity problem? Well, the answer is probably no. We just don't drink enough soda and pop to account for the large increase in obesity. But, you know, on the margin, it might have some beneficial effect, and it can raise some revenue for the state at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Well, here this gets an interesting question. One of the things that people will also point to, if they have a little perspective that comes with age, is that, say, just take that example. We're talking about soft drinks. There has been a tremendous inflation of your average serving size. Now we have fast food companies offering gigantic drinks. And what's interesting is, actually, if you look at it, you see that they make a tremendous amount of money selling these because the raw materials are ridiculously cheap. And if they can get you to go from a, you know, a 16-ounce size to a 32-ounce size, for them, the additional cost of the bigger drink is far outweighed by what they're charging you for the bigger drink. So they found that if they can get you to buy a bigger one, they're going to make a bunch more money. If we believe in the free market, we'd say, okay, let her rip. But then we say, well, all right, is there actually something that we could, as a matter of public policy, we could do to get in there?
Well, you know, you've painted a one side of the story, I'd say, and it has some validity. I mean, I think, you know, I'm trained as an economist, so I think, for example, taxes and raising the price of sodas would decrease the use consumption of soda, but you know, I think it ignores some facts. I mean, the way you presented it, somehow these companies have tricked us into drinking more than we like. In fact, there's a lot of people who really like that we can get 32 ounces of Coke really cheaply now. They drink it; it makes them very happy, and they're not obese. You know, not everybody who drinks soda is obese. So if we tax soda, all the people who get a lot of enjoyment and satisfaction from it would be harmed, and we may decrease obesity only slightly because people will drink something else then. And the other things that they will drink aren't, it's not like they're getting, these things have zero calories. Fruit juice and milk have more calories than soda, than Coca-Cola. So if you know, even if we decrease, if we go from a 16-ounce can of Coke, which has about 200 calories, to an 8-ounce glass of orange juice, which has, you know, 115 calories, we've saved 85 calories only. You know, and are we only going to drink 8 ounces instead of 16 ounces? I'm not sure. So when you start doing the math like that, you see that there's much less scope to reduce the obesity problem through these types of mechanisms.
Mm. You know, one thing certainly we know, one behavior we certainly know that people engage in that has very serious health effects is smoking.
Right.
And that one way we have tried to get at that is by doing public education to say to people, look, this is really bad for your health. If you smoke, really, it'd be good for you to quit. And if you don't smoke, well, don't start smoking. At the same time, though, one of the things that seems to have made a big difference, it seems that, in fact, the one thing we can do to discourage smoking is to make cigarettes really expensive. And so they're very heavily taxed. And in fact, just I don't know if it's just today or within the last day or two, I think there's been an increase in the federal cigarette tax. So there's some evidence that shows that the more expensive we make them, the fewer people will smoke. So then maybe the question is, well, is there, you know, do we take some lesson from that, from our approach to tobacco and what we do to try to discourage people from smoking? Is there anything that we can take from that and apply that to getting people to eat in a more healthy way?
No, I mean, I think there is some analogy there, but the one important difference is that there's very few substitutes for smoking. For example, people have switched from cigarettes to the smokeless tobacco, and that's been a very bad consequence, unintended consequence, because smokeless tobacco, the chewing tobacco, has a lot of oral cancers associated with it. But there's really not that many good substitutes. But, you know, like I was saying, in the case of food, let's say we want to tax fast food. Mm-hmm. You know, do we just pick on McDonald's, Wendy's, Burger King, and so forth, and not the Chinese takeout, not the pizza, not the salad bars in supermarkets? There's so many different substitutes available to people, and substitutes will arise to get around the tax laws, that it becomes very difficult to, in practice, to design a tax policy that could actually raise the price of what I'll call high calories, what some people think are high calorie foods. I mean, here's something people don't know. You know, I have a daughter. If I go to McDonald's and get a Happy Meal with low fat milk and apples, it's about the same calories as if she ate a peanut butter and jelly sandwich with a glass of milk. So it's not that these options aren't there and that they're so much more calories. I mean, So anyway, the ability to tax fast food or types of fast food runs into real practical problems because, unlike cigarettes, there's many, many substitutes that are – it's impractical to tax them all. And if we just tax food in general, that's a very regressive thing that will hurt poor people the most, and that's something we probably don't want to do.
Yeah. We have a caller to talk with, someone in Indiana, in Park County, Indiana, so let's do that. Let's talk with them on our toll-free lines, line four. Hello.
Yes, thank you for taking my question.
Sure.
Some of the issues have already been answered in the most recent series of comments since I dialed in, but I'd like to talk just a little more about the lessons from the cigarette taxing. I am a physician, and over 20 years we've been dealing with issues of stop smoking. And, you know, the tax, until recently, the tax has not been large enough, but it has been a significant factor in people wanting to stop smoking. So to me, it seems like the threshold of cost to decrease a pleasurable behavior that has bad health consequences, smoking in this case, obesity and the topic today, the cost of the tax has got to be very, very high on anything that's pleasurable. So some of those questions were answered, but I guess, I was hoping for somewhat of a numerical number of what he thought it would take in terms of taxing to stop that. The other thing that I would like to, I guess, just emphasize or point out, with obesity, it tends to be small things make a difference in terms of excess calorie intake per day. 100 to 200 calories a day over the course of a year, is a significant amount of weight gain, anywhere from 7 to 15 pounds. And over the course of a decade is a tremendous amount of weight gain. So small fluctuations in dietary intake over time make a big difference. That's both the good news and the bad news in the weight loss, weight gain problem. So I guess I want to be sure that listeners understand that when they talk about public policy, that little things do make a difference. So I will, I'd be curious to hear any comments about those things.
Yeah, Professor Kastner, what do you think?
Yeah, no, it's a couple of points. Number one, I mean, again, there's a lot of evidence that higher cigarette taxes and higher cigarette prices reduced smoking, and that's been occurring for the last 20 or 30 years because cigarette taxes have been going up during that whole period. Recently, in some states, there's been these very large increases. Now, you have to be a little careful about making really big increases because, for example, in Canada, got out way in front of the United States and raising taxes on cigarettes a lot, and all of a sudden everybody in Canada was smoking cigarettes bought in the United States. Here, even in Chicago area, people routinely cross over to Indiana to buy cigarettes in Indiana where they're cheaper. So taxes engender black markets and smuggling. So if they get too high, people will evade taxes. Now, but that's the one thing. But in food, and in high-calorie foods, whether you call it McDonald's, fast food, whatever the food you're trying to tax, it becomes very practically difficult to design a tax that will be effective. For example, do you just pick burger joints or pizza joints or Chinese food or supermarket food? There's so many substitutes, so many ways of providing the consumer with. And the thing that you can't forget is consumer likes it. Everybody knows that the Big Mac has a lot of calories. They go, they order it because they love it. Now, getting them to stop doing something is if we think as a society that's the right thing, okay, we're being a little paternalistic because we think they just don't know what's good for themselves. But in fact, they do know what's good for themselves. So, the use of taxes is a very much more complicated than the caller kind of suggested. There's a lot involved. Then on the second issue about these small differences, this is the public health community has latched on to this idea that 50 calories a day, 100 calories a day are going to make big differences in your weight. This is not a very well-documented fact. It comes from one or two studies that do these kind of gross calculations to come up with how much calories have changed over a 20-year period? How much has weight changed? What does that infer about the average calories per day? But in fact, in studies, when they strap on meters and they get participants to actually increase exercise by 100 calories a day, to burn off 100 calories a day, there is absolutely no weight loss. So this idea that very small differences matter is something that the public health community likes to hold on to because it makes policies seem like they'll be much more effective. There hasn't been very many effective policies out there, and the reason is it's a much more complicated and difficult problem than we want to recognize. Mainly, as opposed to what David, you had said, obesity is mainly a personal responsibility, people making decisions voluntarily and satisfying these pleasurable aspects of life. So,
I would like to make a follow-up comment.
Yes.
Again, I'm not talking about large-scale studies and that sort of thing. Again, as a physician and personal experience, the patients that I see that have been successful in losing weight have predominantly done it by small alterations in behavior, such things as they gave up bedtime snacks, they gave up, you know, a dessert. They weren't radical changes, and they were small calories. So there can be a lot of, you know, scientific argument and things like that from an academic standpoint, but from the perspective of clinical medicine and behavior, that on observational things that people can put into their daily lives, these small changes in behavior and somewhat small calorie changes do make a difference. So I guess... You know, I don't think we can resolve that, but I guess I would like you to appreciate that clinical observation shows it's
but these changes do occur.
The second thing that I think people need to remember on public policy and cigarette smoking, again, from a practical clinical basis, there's been a decrease in smoking over the years. There's been a decrease, or there has been an increase in cigarette taxes, and but I think it's a great assumption, or too great of assumption, to think that the decrease in smoking has been due to the steady increase in taxes. It is a factor, but it, again, clinically, to me, it seems like bigger factors have been public education and awareness of the many bad effects of cigarette smoking and the change in social acceptance of smoking, that those two things have been a much bigger factor than the taxes alone until recently, when the taxes have become huge. So I'll just throw those points out, and I will hang up, and I don't have any more rebuttal, and
right.
I'm enjoying what you have to say.
Well, thanks for the call. Professor Kestner, again, any further
comments? I agree with the caller. We're not going to resolve this, but, the caller uses the word clinical a lot to imbue the comments with some, and at the same time says, but not scientific studies. Well, there's lots of scientific studies in clinical settings that suggest very little success in weight loss, in really getting people to lose weight. If there's no diets that have proven particularly successful, people lose weight, gain weight back, and that's the bottom line. If there were these magic bullets that are very easy, we wouldn't have seen obesity grow so much as we've seen it grow.
Let me again introduce our guest. We're just a little bit here past our midpoint of this hour, talking with Robert Kestner. He's professor in the U of I Chicago's Department of Economics. He's a member of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs. He's also a research associate for the National Bureau of Economic Research. He's an expert in health and labor economics. He's one of the contributors to the Illinois Report 2009, something that's been now put together for the past few years by the Institute of Government and Public Affairs. Many different people have contributed chapters. There's discussion here of Illinois' economy, of educational issues, of issues that have to do with health. And if you'd like to read it, you can read it online by going to the website of the Institute, or you can get a copy from them if you'd like to have a print copy. And questions are welcome here, too, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We're talking about obesity, causes, consequences, public policy solutions, something that Professor Kestner has written about in this new issue of the Illinois Report 2009. Well, again, carrying on with this, you know, how it is that very government in a way has tried to respond to this issue. I'm just curious about how you think about something else here. And I go back, I find myself going back to your comment about how that maybe calorie-wise, a Happy Meal and low-fat milk is the same as a PBJ. I think if we had a nutritionist here, she would tell us that it's not just about total calories, it's also about quality of calories. And you don't want all of your calories to come from fat. And if we look at some of the kind of food that you find in places like McDonald's, I think that she will say, you know, here in a lot of these meals, a lot of the calories come from fat. Sodium levels are also very high. So what some people have suggested, and I think in some places they've actually tried to do this, that maybe is there something we can do, or should we think about trying to do something about the nature of the food that restaurants like this serve, and if not encourage them, somehow force them to serve to create and make available a healthier product?
Well, yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, there's the regulations for using trans fats in the cooking process. Here in Chicago, we outlawed foie gras, which and then rescinded that law. So, I mean, there is some, but the first point I'd like to make, I think the evidence is very clear that in terms of just weight, it's just calories. That it does, you know, there was just a study, I think, in the New England Journal of Medicine or the Journal of the American Medical Association that was a randomized trial of four different diets, you know, all the popular diets, one just eating meat, one just eating the Mediterranean diet, and all of them resulted in the same amount of weight loss. It's just, in terms of what your weight is, it's a matter, almost solely a matter of how many calories you put in your body, and regardless of where those calories come from. Now, in terms of other illnesses, I think the composition of what goes in, you know, in terms of fats and sodium, I'm not a nutritionist in this regard, but so this is just my reading of the evidence, but it may matter more for those types of things than for obesity per se.
Like heart disease and high blood pressure, for example,
Right, but in terms of just weight, I think the calories really are the dominant, you know, just the number of calories you put in, whether it's calories from Twinkies or steak. If unfortunately, you probably would eat more Twinkies because it takes a lot more of them or a lot fewer of them to get the calories, maybe. But but in terms of, you know, what the quality of the food, what you refer to as the quality, I think that it has more to do with, you know, the kind of illnesses that may arise from the different types of foods we put in, but not through weight in that regard. I mean, one thing, to be a little bit more optimistic, I think if we look, one of the strongest things correlated with obesity is education. More educated people are much less likely to be obese. They're much less likely to smoke. I mean, getting people to be more educated has so many health benefits. It's probably our most effective policy in this regard.
Well, just – and I have a caller here. I promise I'll get right to them. But I guess does that really mean that at the end of the day, if we're concerned about this particular thing about obesity, or maybe we're also concerned about heart disease and high blood pressure and diabetes and other conditions like that that have lifestyle components – do you think that at the end of the day, really, the most effective thing that can be done is public education, and that we tell people this is what a healthy diet looks like, and this is what a healthy activity level, and these are the consequences of not living that way, and we hope that you will take this to heart and go out there and make a good decision for yourself, and that then at the end of the day, that's really all we can do is hope that people indeed will make the good decision for themselves.
Yeah, I don't think it's all we can do, but I think it would be the most effective thing we can do, and I think it can start at very early ages by teaching young children the benefits of investment and patience and future rewards. The idea, you know, if you don't, you know, take the marshmallow now, you'll get more rewards later on in the future. I mean, that starts very early in life. And that's the biggest – look, I go to the gym. I hate going to the gym, right? I hate it. But the only reason I do it because I recognize the benefits. And that's a very, you know, that's a very hard thing to instill. And I've tried to instill this in my young daughter. So, I mean, I want to include that in education also. So we can –
All right. Well, let's talk to some more folks here, people who are listening. And next, we'll talk with someone in Mahomet, line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
my question or my statement would be, and you just touched on it, Professor, exercise. Very important. The other thing is the demographics of the country, I believe, in the last 10, 20 years have moved to the cities, and it's less, probably less conducive to get out and a good place to go and exercise. I don't live in a city, so I have plenty of places to go, but I know when I have lived in cities, at that time there were a few parks around that you get to for exercise, but gee, the internet is in there as well, and kids like to play games. We all like to sit down and get, you know, gain information, and guess what? We're sitting down too much. So that's my comment.
Right. Well,
I think it's very important. I mean, the technology has changed dramatically in this country. Work is much less physically demanding than it used to be. Leisure time activities are much less demanding. It's a lot of fun to play video games, to watch DVDs, television on demand, instead of going to play tennis, right? When there was nothing on TV, tennis looked like a good option. When there was no video games, you know, playing ball outside was a good option. But so as technology has changed dramatically in all facets of our life, work, play, and transportation, we are much less physically active. And now, the problem is that ship has sailed. To try to undo that those things is being a little bit of a Luddite in this regard. So it's very hard. That those are great things. People enjoy them immensely. They're not going to be undone. So there's a lot of people out there who call for dramatically redesigning cities and keeping people more in the cities, actually. People think that living in the city where you walk more is a better thing. So, but the you know, in my mind, that ship has sailed. To try to rewrite history is not a very productive way to proceed.
All right, let's go next to Champagne. This is a caller on line 3. Hello.
Yes, I couldn't disagree more with regard to cities. I study Japan and live there quite a bit. And I can tell you that the Japanese people have to ride their bikes, and they have to get to their local station. Metropolitan societies, if you did a study, I would wager that the health is superior in a variety of ways in terms of on a variety of fronts, I would say that. The other thing is, too, that my mother, who's 78 years of age, born in 1930, German-American background, large woman, but not heavy. In fact, she's never been very heavy. And something that's very different between her and my siblings, the daughters in particular, is that they're quite heavy. And she, throughout her life, always, she lived through the Depression, and she drank hot tea. And she still drinks hot tea. She occasionally drinks pop. But my sisters, of course, were raised on pop. That was what modern people do in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and so forth. And to this day, she's in much better health. And in spite of eating quite a number of sweets and so forth, that's helped quite a bit. So, you know, the metropolitan issue, I think, is a very, very important one. I think it's the burbs that are killing us on some level. In other words, we had rural areas, but we have the car. And I think there's not that there's collusion of Detroit and so forth, but historically, the more we depend on the car to get around, there's been problems associated with that. Likewise, not to accuse the industry of collusion, but we have moved from the days when chips in my day in the 70s, the only chips you had were what they call classic chips now. You didn't have the kinds of bizarre combinations that you could purchase in groceries and so forth, and people's habits have declined insofar as when you consider the family, families tend not to oftentimes eat together in the evenings. When I was a child, everyone did. By the late 70s, people didn't do that anymore. I think there's a variety of factors that's not only related to calories. It's a cultural issue of lifestyle, and the fact that so many Asians that I know, including Japanese Americans, that are fat when they move to the United States has a lot to do, of course, with calories, but also, I really believe, with lifestyle. And so I'll hang up and just listen. Thank
you. All right.
No, I think the caller makes great points. I think the evidence suggests that living in a city where you walk more and, where you have to walk more, you use a car less, provides you with some marginal benefit. But again, the caller wants to implies that, well, you know, now that women work much more than they did in the 60s and 70s, that this is a bad thing because now families don't eat at home and they go out for fast food. But that's incorrect. Women working in families is a great thing. Women's lives have improved dramatically. Then that ship is never going to return to the dock. Women are not going to stay home and cook meals for their family anymore like they used to. And I don't want to put the burden on women, but that's a traditional historical role. Now everybody in the family is working, and thank God there are fast food places around that they can go and get a quick meal. That's a very time-saving, beneficial thing for the family. It's not a negative. The family has voluntarily made those decisions. It's made them all better off as a whole. So, you know, these life going to the suburbs, people, you know, we built highway system, and that expanded the suburbs, probably. And that was a government policy, and that was what I mentioned before. But people like the suburbs because they get cheaper, bigger houses out there than they could in the cities. And as their incomes have grown, they like to consume bigger houses with yards. That gives them great satisfaction. They're not going to change to come back to the city because, hey, you know, that might take a couple of pounds off.
Hmm. So there is really, I mean, I can see your point that in terms of the business of changing the way that cities are designed would be difficult, if not impossible, maybe not impossible, but certainly very difficult. So we shouldn't expect any really big changes to happen anytime soon. And one could say, well, it would be great if we could do some things to encourage people to walk, or it would be great if we could encourage people to ride bicycles. Is there really nothing that could be done, or do you think that there could be some small things that somehow could be done?
No, I think all those things you just mentioned, we can do more to encourage people to ride bicycles, to walk, to have bike lanes in Chicago like mm-hmm. they do, to have more, accessible areas to walk on sidewalks, have sidewalks in suburban areas. Right now there aren't a lot of them. So there's small things that we can do that aren't relatively costly that will have some beneficial effect. But they're all going to be nibbling at the margin. I really see the big thing that can really reverse this in a much more significant way is to, you know, really increase the average levels of education in the country. And obesity is just not that big of a problem among those with, say, college degrees.
Hmm.
And so, you know, I'll leave it there. I mean, that's a real big, you know, and here, for example, in Chicago, we have 50% of people not graduating high school. It's just incredible.
Just real quick, and I promise I have callers when you get to, one thing that you do talk about here as something that maybe we could do, and it ties in a sense, one of the things that has happened over the years in terms of what life is like in our public schools is that it seems that there's much less physical activity. In fact, there may be some places where, certainly when I was in school, we had PE. There may be some places where they've gotten away from that as a requirement, or maybe they don't provide as many opportunities for students to participate in sports. Would that be something that would be good, and would there be something that we could do to encourage schools, public schools, to put that back, make that a regular part of the school day?
No, I think that is one issue that would be, again, one small issue that would be helpful. Illinois, in fact, mandates daily physical activity for K through 12. Although I think some schools, particularly in more urban areas, don't meet that mandate because of security concerns. So Illinois is out in front in that. But in general, you're correct that there has been some decline in daily physical activity, particularly among the older children, the adolescents and high schoolers. So I think that would be an important thing to keep, maintain and keep in place and not to allowed to erode.
All right. Our guest is Robert Kessner. He's professor at the University of Illinois, Chicago, in the Department of Economics. He's also a member of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs. We're talking about that obesity as a public policy issue and in what sorts of ways might government do something to influence that in a positive direction. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And we'll get right back to the phones here with someone in Chicago, line four. Hello.
Hello. I was going to just mention a couple of examples which I've seen that where the government programs actually contribute to obesity or, you know, breakdown of health. One, I knew a guy who qualified for the free government cheese program, and he took his family there every week and had that, had him eat cheese all the time, and he ended up having a heart bypass and Like I say, I don't think it helped him very much. But another time I was in a store, and, the guy in front of me, he must have been about 300 pounds, and his cart was filled with, potato chips and pop. It looked like he was going to have a party. And he pulled out his, food stamps, or actually it's a card now, it's a link card, but he paid for it with the food stamp program. And I just say, well, you know, the government could be a little more selective in what they pay for, at least, or, you know, what they're giving people.
Well, Professor Kastner?
Obesity is not a problem of just for the poor, and, how paternalistic do you want to get? I'm not sure. I mean, the government, food stamps, for example, already has quite a few programs to try to educate people on what are the good foods to eat, healthy foods to eat. It doesn't allow you it never allows you to buy alcohol, for example. So the government does try to, along with these programs that provide food, and the WIC program, for example, also tries to educate people about healthier foods to eat. Again, I would point to the education issue. A lot of times, low-income people are also people with limited educations, and that issue goes hand in hand. I think the caller really points out an educational problem, and I think he was encouraging the government to do more in that area. It has done some. Again, I think it could do more. Would it be a big influence? I'm not sure.
All right. I want to thank the caller. We have several in just about 5-6 minutes, so I want to get to someone, particularly someone here who's on a cell phone. Line one. Hello.
Hi. I guess I'm having trouble following the thesis. It sounds like the plan is to solve obesity through education, and it was just mentioned now, and that was actually one of my points, that people with education have more money, and it's a lot easier to make a healthy choice when you have money, because the high calorie food is really cheap. I'm glad that point was brought up at the end of the discussion, even as an afterthought, because it's an important factor. And, whether through subsidies or taxes or something, I think that makes a difference in people's choices. It's not just the education. It's how much money you have in your pocket, because, the nice food that's better for you is typically more expensive. But I'm having trouble following the thesis about what is the cause and what is to be done. It sounds like that it's being said that we don't eat any more calories than we did, 30 years ago, and we're just less active. But the real cause of obesity is lack of education. So are we less educated? It's just confused. I'm not sure what's being said here and what the proposed solution is. And if it is education, where does the money come from? Does it come from agricultural subsidies for, like, corn syrup or what? I'm having trouble following this.
Let me clarify then. I apologize for the confusion. We consume many more calories, and we're less active than we used to be over the last 30 years, for example. The causes of that are long-term declines in the price of high-calorie foods because of technological innovation like high-fructose corn syrup, and because of technological changes that make our work, leisure, and transportation much less physically active. Those are the long-term trends in society that are the fundamental causes of us eating more and doing less. Now, how do you reverse those trends? My argument is that to try to say everybody move back to the cities, everybody go out and get a physically demanding job, everybody go out and play tennis instead of using their computer are not really realistic. We're not going to turn the clock back on technological change. All women should not work, prepare homemade foods. These types of gross long-term trends in society have been very beneficial, have generated lots of welfare increases for people. They're not going to be turned back. So in the absence of turning these long-term issues back, what can we do? We can do some things around the edges, physical activity in school. I would agree, maybe charging some taxes for soft drinks. But really, the only thing that's really going to make a significant effect, at least in my opinion, is providing higher levels of education, higher levels of self-control, impulse control, and that starts very young. So that's my thesis. I hope it's clearer now.
I think so. Thank you.
All right. And is that are you saying that somehow this should be more part of the educational curriculum, or that somehow government should be doing something outside of that, some kind of public service kind of education to reinforce that message?
Well, the public service education, I mean, the nutritional area is just a minefield of information that keeps changing, every 5 years. So the public is very wary of any new nutritional claims. And in fact, advertisers and industry is very clever about manipulating the public message to label, for example, every very high-calorie food, non-fat, food. So that's been a real problem, actually, and not something that's been beneficial. So for things like food labels and stuff, they've been shown to have very little positive effect. It's really the kind of general education, analytical ability, the ability to process information, to recognize the benefits of future, of current investments in the future. Those types of issues are really the kinds of things that have bigger impacts on health behaviors, weight gain, obesity, exercise, and the important things that will actually control your weight.
We'll get at least, I think, one more caller here. The next person in line is in Champaign, and line three. Hello.
Yes, I think I was misunderstood a little earlier. I was kind of surprised once I turned the phone off, but my mother has never worked, and I was noting that we did not eat dinner together and so forth, and that's very, very common. I was not associating eating dinners and so forth with the working of women is undermining that. In fact, in Japan, about half of all women work, and families still eat together. There are plenty of familial problems and so forth. But one thing, I am in complete agreement that education is important. It depends on how you define education. For one thing, government, as you know, the past 8 years and even earlier, the government agencies and so forth have decreasingly, they have not, well, there has been a great effort on the television and so forth to sell a whole variety of products to the public and so forth. And the kind of news you hear, as you were noting, you get all kinds of different claims regarding nutrition. It would seem that the improvement of government agencies, public presentation and so forth, and also perhaps in schools, that would be something that would improve people's knowledge of, the kinds of foods and so forth that have fewer calories, the kind of lifestyle that improves that. By the way, one other thing, it's not inevitable that we've gone to the suburbs because L.A. used to have a subway system around 1930, and that was destroyed through political influence from Detroit. So we don't necessarily not have to have a society full of suburbs. And in fact, I think the United States should move in the direction of large-scale, major subway and train systems. I think that would provide for the kind of lifestyle that goes beyond simply trying to get a larger house.
Well, let me just I need to jump in here because we're almost out of time. And Professor Kestner, I can give you a minute to respond however you would like.
The caller makes some good points. I don't think we have to give up on trying to make some changes that would be beneficial. Increasing mass transit would be a good way to bring people closer together, living in more central hubs where they can walk more. It's just the claims are always outsized. That there's always, this is yet another magic bullet. If all the claims of how to reduce obesity were put together, we'd reduce obesity by 200 or 300%. It's just there are no real easy answers, and most of obesity is because of voluntary changes due to long-term trends in society, technological and cultural, and recognizing that has got to be a fundamental part of the solution. So.
Well, there we'll have to stop. Our guest, Robert Kestner, is professor at the U of I Chicago in the Department of Economics. He's also a member of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs, one of the contributors to the Illinois Report 2009 put together by the Institute. If you're interested, you can get more information by going to their website. IGPA is the initials, and you can follow it from there. You can get you can read the report there, or you can also get a copy in print if you would like. And Professor Kestner, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you, David.
Today's broadcast made possible by Carle Foundation Hospital. Carle Foundation Hospital provided more than $80 million in community benefit last year, including almost $10 million in free or discounted care. More information about how Carle embraces its charitable mission is on its annual report at carle.org. And that's it for us here on Focus 580, but we want you to stay tuned. Much more coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. The host for that show is Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, we'll explore the practice of silence. Our guest will be Anne LeClaire. She is the author most recently of Listening Below the Noise, a meditation on the practice of silence. Let's take a look now at commodity prices. In Kansas City, May wheat is trading at 587.5, up 21.5. July, 597, up 20. Chicago, May, 546.75, up 21.25. July, 558.5, up 20.25. May corn, 402.25, up 6.25. July, 412, up 5.75. September, 421, up 5.75. December, 433.25, up 6. May beans, 981.75, up 29.75. July, 981.5, up 30. August, 966, up 29.5. September, 936.75, up 29.75. November beans, 917.5, up 25.5. May meal, 301.40, up 7.10. May oil, 34.92, up 1.42. Livestock contracts now. April live cattle, 85.35, up 157.5. June, 83.45, up 207.5. April feeder cattle, 94.95.